Reach into your wallet for me, would you? Take out a dollar bill. Have a good look at it and then answer this question. Does it inspire economic confidence? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 24 January. Thanks, as always, for being here, everybody. We are going to spend some time today with the dollar, the greenback, the world's reserve currency, as practitioners in the foreign exchange markets know it. We're going to do that because today the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, said something truly extraordinary. He said, and this is a quote, "Obviously, a weaker dollar is good for us as it relates to trade and opportunities," end quote. Now, that was extraordinary because it has been the stated policy of the American government for decades now that we want a strong dollar, that a dollar that's performing well against other currencies inspires confidence in the American economy and is a symbol of our international economic prowess. But at the same time, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, Mnuchin was right, kinda.
When the U.S. dollar gets weaker, it's as if products made by U.S. companies are on sale in other countries. Think about the two airline manufacturers, Boeing, an American company, and Airbus, a European one. They sell planes all over the world. Mike Bailey, research director at FBB Capital Partners, says with the dollar falling,
all of a sudden, some of these customers, global customers, just got a nice discount for buying a Boeing plane. But at the same time, they're getting a modest increase in the price of that Airbus plane.
So they'll probably go with the Boeing. Another U.S. export that could benefit from a weak dollar, international tourism. Jack McIntyre is a portfolio manager at Brandywine Global.
You're going to see more tourists come to the U.S. because it's cheaper to come see the sights in the U.S. when the dollar's weak.
If all of this happens, a weaker dollar could achieve a long-stated goal of the Trump administration, lowering the $50.5 billion U.S. trade deficit. Mauro Guillen teaches management at the Wharton School.
Imports are likely to go down and exports are likely to go up. And therefore, the trade deficit most likely will shrink a little bit.
After Treasury Secretary Mnuchin talked about the U.S. dollar today in Davos, it dropped to a three-year low. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Look, I hear you. Currency can be tough to wrap your brain around, but this is one of those fundamental macroeconomic stories. A weak dollar, as Mariel said, can be good for the American export economy, so stipulated. But there is more going on here. The dollar is, as I said, the world's reserve currency. It's what people want to buy. Sometimes the currency itself, sometimes dollar-denominated American government debt, when things start looking shaky. Provided the dollar is strong. When the dollar falls over time, as it has been doing for a while now, some not necessarily good things happen. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that part of the story.
So let's start real basic. When you buy a treasury bond, you lend the U.S. government some money for a set period of time. Along the way, you also get set interest payments.
The interest rate that a country pays is not out of generosity. It's to compensate investors for some kind of risk.
Mark Chandler is the head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
But what we're talking about here now is that a new risk is presenting itself, and that risk is of a falling U.S. dollar.
Nearly half of all Treasury investors are foreign. So if the value of the dollar drops, suddenly their money is worth less when they bring it back to their home country. So that investor is going to want more interest to compensate for this currency risk. Kathy Jones is the chief fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab.
It gets harder and harder to finance our deficits if we have a declining dollar.
And this is happening at a time when the U.S. will be issuing a lot more debt in the coming years to pay for recent tax cuts.
We'll still be able to finance it. It just means we'll have to finance it at a higher price for us.
Jones says ideally we'd find some equilibrium that manages the negative aspects of a weak dollar, like higher borrowing costs, and its positives, like more competitive exports. However that nets out, there are some advantages that stem directly from the dollar being the world's reserve currency, as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
So nobody officially declared the dollar the international reserve currency, says Joel Prakken, an economist at Macroeconomic Advisors.
The adoption of the dollar as a reserve currency is not something that we foisted on the rest of the world. It's something that they wanted.
The dollar's become the global baseline to price things, especially raw goods, steel, wheat, oil, because of its predictable, stable track record. Dean Baker's an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says efficient trade needs some universal language.
think of it like if you and I were trading things. I wanted to buy your TV and you wanted to buy my car. Well, we could do some barter deal, but most likely we'd just say, okay, you're going to pay me $200 for the TV. I'll pay you $2,000 for the car. It's convenient.
It's especially convenient for American firms and important if you're talking barrels of oil and not old TVs. The amount of oil that foreign buyers can afford changes when their currency fluctuates. American companies don't have to recalculate. Here's another benefit, says Joel Pracken.
Being the reserve currency just increases the liquidity in the foreign exchange market surrounding dollars, and that greases the wheels of all sorts of commerce that's conducted in dollars.
And since U.S. firms deal in dollars every step of the way, their finances are more predictable and stable. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One more thing here before we leave the foreign exchange markets. You remember how Mario was explaining a weak dollar makes American exports more attractive to overseas buyers? There is, of course, a flip side to that, right? It costs more for American companies to buy things made overseas and sell them to American consumers. And here is the catch with that. American consumers love and have come to expect bargains. So retailers don't have a whole lot of pricing power in this economy, and they thus can't necessarily raise prices to cover the costs of those imported goods. So their profits fall, and investors notice, and maybe don't think those companies' stock prices should be so high. And you see where I'm going with this, right? Call it Newtonian economics. For every action, there is a sometimes equal and often opposite reaction. About stock prices, by the way, kind of sideways on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Ten years. Somehow a really long time, but also somehow the blink of an economic eye, really. We are rolling out a year-long project this week across the Marketplace programs, How the Financial Crisis of 2008 and the Decade That Followed Changed This Country. We're calling it Divided Decade, what the Great Recession did to the people and the institutions of this economy. The generally accepted theory of the crisis, setting aside for a minute avarice, mismanagement, and human nature, is that the American housing market crashed and then all of the rest of the bad stuff happened, which gets us to this next interview. Tim Mayopoulos is the CEO of Fannie Mae, one of the two big government-sponsored mortgage companies that got into so much trouble in the crisis. Mayopoulos started at Fannie Mae in the spring of 2009 after the worst had passed, but before really anybody knew how things were going to turn out. We started when we chatted with the nuts and bolts. For those who aren't entirely familiar with what this place does, give me the 30-second, this is what we do.
Okay, so here at Fannie Mae, we're in the mortgage business, but we don't make mortgages to consumers, to borrowers. What we do is we buy mortgages from folks who originate mortgages, whether it's a credit union or a bank or an independent mortgage bank, which gives them more money to go out and make more loans. And we take the mortgages that we buy and we put them into mortgage-backed securities, and we guarantee the purchasers of those securities that we'll cover all the principal and interest payments in the event that the borrower doesn't make them. So what does all that do? What that does is it enables us to attract global capital to the U.S. housing markets at very efficient rates.
Is it fair to say you all make the American housing industry work?
We are really a fundamental backbone of the U.S. housing industry. If you think about it, we finance roughly 30% of all the mortgages in the United States. We have a $3 trillion balance sheet. So if you drive down the typical street of a regular neighborhood in the United States and you look at the houses on it, roughly one in three of them is going to be financed with a Fannie Mae mortgage.
Can't talk to the guy running Fannie Mae without saying the following phrase. Financial crisis. You're nodding seriously.
Financial crisis was a profound effect on the country, but also a profound effect on us. I came to Fannie Mae in the wake of the financial crisis. I'd been in financial services a long time, but decided to come to Fannie Mae precisely because of the financial crisis and that housing was really at the center of the crisis. My view was that I wanted to take my modest talents, whatever they were, and bring them to an institution that was really important to housing. There are a lot of people who would say that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were really at the cause of the financial crisis. I don't agree with that. There are many contributing causes to the crisis, but clearly being able to sustain the housing finance system through the crisis was absolutely critical to the recovery.
Which is part of how we got to, and I don't want to go back too far into the crisis because there's lots to talk about what you're doing now, but that's how we got to September the 5th of 2008, where the government says, listen, you're ours, basically, and you enter into conservatorship. After having been known as government-sponsored entities, right, and backstopped by the full faith and credit of the government, I guess the question is, should the American government be in the business of guaranteeing mortgages?
It's a fair question that people ought to ask. We don't have to have a housing finance system where the government implicitly or explicitly backs a big part of the market. We don't have to have that. But what people don't remember is that Fannie Mae came out of the Great Depression,
right,
because the way people financed homes in those days is they got a 3 or 5 year bullet loan, and then they had to roll it over with a new loan from a new institution. And at the end of those 3 or 5 years, they couldn't find another institution to give them a new mortgage.
Right.
So they lost their house to foreclosure. FDR recognized that, and the government decided we're going to make sure that we have liquid markets, that we're going to have credit available in all markets at all times, all across our country, and that people will be able to finance that with a very long-term instrument.
Okay, but the Depression was a very long time ago. The American financial system is much more sophisticated now, much more liquid now. Do you doubt that private investment would come were you to be dissolved, as some lawmakers and many policymakers say, listen, let's get rid of these two?
Look, I have no doubt that private capital ought to play the primary role of backing the housing finance
system. Say that again. Here's a guy who runs Fannie Mae saying private capital ought to be doing it.
Private capital ought to be the primary source of funding for the housing markets, huh, in the United States. And in fact, the innovations that we've been a big part of since conservatorship was imposed, yeah, 9 years ago have contributed to that. So if you think historically, Fannie Mae has this enormous balance sheet. We're making all these loans. We have 18 million mortgage loans on our balance sheet. Oof. Historically, we would have held all of that credit risk for the life of those assets. Today, we don't do that. We now transfer a very significant part of that credit risk to private capital. In other words, we're essentially getting reinsurance on what we have. So people have the impression that Fannie and Freddie are continuing to take all this risk. We still take some risk, but we are transferring a very, very big part of that risk to private capital.
What do your friends, you were on Wall Street for a long time, so what do your friends at Bank of America or JP Morgan or wherever, what do they say when you guys go to whatever meetings you go to and this comes up and you say, you know what, you guys ought to be doing this. You ought to be on the hook.
You know, I think there is private capital out there that will take that risk if properly compensated for it. At least it will do that in most markets at most times.
Yeah.
One of the things people need to understand is that the capital markets work until they don't work. There are moments when they just seize up. And that's why an institution like Fannie Mae exists, so that when your local bank won't make you a mortgage loan, that we're out there to say, no, we'll actually continue to provide liquidity to this market.
Do you ever go to your regulators and say, listen, can we lose this conservatorship thing?
You know,
Or is that just a non-starter?
No. Look, I'd say our regulator has been on record clearly and consistently saying that conservatorship is not a sustainable state, and that ultimately you need to bring private capital back to this market in bigger scale, and that you need to be able to release these institutions or create some other institutions to operate the system without this kind of government oversight.
I want to make sure I understand. It sounds like you're amenable to, if not Fannie Mae going away entirely, but then certainly pulling back from where you are in this mortgage business.
We're certainly open to that. We're not wedded to an old system. We're actually committed to making a better housing finance system. I'm probably one of the very few CEOs who stood up in front of his entire company and said, you know what, we have to recognize the fact that the legal entity that we work for, Fannie Mae, may cease to exist at some point. Not many CEOs stand up and say that, okay? But I've stood up more than once and said that and said, but that's not what your focus should be. Your focus should be on being here and being part of creating a housing finance system that will support the needs of this country for the next 20 or 30 years. A lot of people are focused on what happened 10 years ago.
Right.
What we really need to be focused on as a country is, what do we want the housing finance system 10 years from now or 20 years from now to look like?
Tim, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Divided Decade is the name of the project. Corner Office is the name of the podcast, where you can catch the rest of my talk with Tim Mayopoulos, including his thoughts on the next housing crisis he was talking about and the sorry state of affordable housing in this country. Coming up, you know the do not call list?
Once you put your number on it, there's some technological wizardry or legal muscle that is going to prevent anyone from even calling you. That's not true.
Wait, what? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 41 today, about a 10%, finished at 26,252. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ off 45.6%, 74.15. S&P 500 basically flat, 28.37 there. Tech was troubled on this day. Chipmaker Texas Instruments played 8.4% lower after posting a disappointing revenue forecast for the current quarter. Rival Applied Materials cast off 1.5%. Apple, in case you're curious, wilted 1.5% today. United Continental, look out, airlines, dropped 11.4% after it announced plans to increase capacity. Investors thus feared lower prices and profit margins. Other carriers dipped as well. American Airlines off 6% today. Southwest down 4.6%. Delta off 5.2%. Banks were buoyed? I don't know. How do you pronounce that? Rising bond yields was the cause. Let them charge higher interest rates, of course, on loans. Bank of America deposited 0.5%. Citigroup up 1.1%. Bond prices fell. Speaking of interest rates, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. I think it's buoyed. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. So we were talking to Tim Mayopoulos before the break, a guy running one of the key economic institutions in the country. The thing is, people are the real driver of things, right? And you can't talk about the financial crisis and the Great Recession without talking about how the decade we have all just lived through changed us, how it changed how we feel about our own economies and how we think about our futures. In 2008, Pat St. Clair was covering the crisis for CNN in Atlanta.
It's a funny thing, you know, with journalists. It's like an out-of-body experience when you're covering a story. It's not really me. It is me, but it's not personal. There was so much talk at that time about subprime mortgages and, you know, all of the people who had gotten fooled or tricked. And I had a legit mortgage, so I actually thought I was fine. What did happen, it really wasn't about the mortgage so much as the mortgage company. When they had bought my mortgage, they'd had it for several years. And during that period, they had never taken out the escrow. I went from 1 month, my mortgage being $650, to the next month, almost double. I wasn't able to pay it. I was just like, are you kidding me? And I got really behind and actually got almost to a foreclosure. I didn't feel like it was legal. I even got a lawyer. And ultimately, the lawyer said, well, it's not illegal, but it was immoral because it was their fault. When you work at CNN, people think you're rich. People think, oh, you must be making buku loads of money. And plus, I have been on the air doing headline news. So, of course, people thought, probably thought I was a millionaire. So nothing could have been farther from the truth. But covering the story itself, I can sort of just detach myself. And then when I come home, yeah, okay, I'm pissed and whatever. But there was definitely a lot of shame attached to it. Well, fast forward, it's interesting. I am 62. I got laid off from CNN. So I'm really trying to figure out what this next step is. And really, I'm worried about the same things that I was worried about 10 years ago, financial stability and trying to get some kind of nest egg going. And at this age, you know, it's a little harder. Just going through the whole experience itself, it certainly made me a lot less, like, more cynical and less hopeful. And it made me a little bit less of the happy-go-lucky person that I was. But that could just be age, too.
We've got pictures of Pat St. Clair on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. We're using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. We'd love for you to post your story and a selfie or two. Our year-long series, one more time, is called Divided Decade. There used to be a thing in this economy called telemarketing. Companies calling you often at inconvenient times to sell you something. That got out of hand, shall we say. So the government came up with the Do Not Call Registry, which worked for a while until telemarketing became robocalls, of which there are billions made a month. And that Do Not Call Registry could not keep up. Simon Van Zwalenwood wrote about the reality of the Do Not Call list in the Washington Post. Simon, thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
I have a note here on my little yellow pad that I wrote down as I was reading this article. And it says, in all capital letters talking about the Do Not Call list, it does nothing! Exclamation point. Explain why the Do Not Call list is really a little bit of a joke.
I think most people who are on the Do Not Call list or are aware of the Do Not Call list have this apprehension that once you put your number on it, there's some technological wizardry legal muscle that is going to prevent anyone from even calling you. That's not true.
That's me, by the way. I'm a believer, and I honestly I was crushed to find out it was not true.
I was crushed too. what really happens is this. You put your number on it, and it goes into a massive database. There's about 230 million numbers on it right now. So almost everybody in the country, well, a majority of the people in the country seem to have their numbers on the Do Not Call list. And yet the only thing that it does is if somebody calls it enough times, or if enough numbers on the list, I should say, are violated by a certain robocaller, the government, represented by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission in this instance, will in theory jump in and track down and prosecute the offending dialer.
I love the emphasis on in theory, because in reality, none of that happens.
Yeah. I mean, the Federal Trade Commission is a teeny tiny government body that doesn't have the time, money, or manpower to prosecute these guys. And even if they did, the problem is they're incredibly hard to track down. The few successful instances of robocall syndicate prosecution, if you want to call it that, have, you know, unearthed boiler rooms in India or boiler rooms in some random part of Orange County, California. But it's few and far between.
All right. So just as there is technological advantage working for the robocallers, there has to be some kind of technological advantage that the good guys can employ.
Essentially right. So if the extent of the Do Not Call list was that good telemarketers would police themselves out of existence, the bad guys won't do that because they're not afraid of getting caught. They make too much money and they're too hard to catch. So the government a few years ago sort of threw up its hands and kind of lobbed it over to the private sector. And they sort of asked Silicon Valley to create apps that would block calls on your cell phones or your landlines. And indeed, in the last few years, a number of call blocking apps have surfaced. The problem is they all work differently. They all block different numbers. Most of them don't work on your landline, which means there's no universal fix. You have to download all of them. And even then, a lot of calls are going to slip through.
Are we then just doomed to a future of robocall hell?
I don't want to say yes, but I did a lot of research on this, and the only solution I could see on the horizon might be something called caller ID authentication. That would work like the little blue check mark next to your Twitter account.
Oh, and we know how great Twitter is. Come on, man. Right?
That's right. Nothing untoward ever slips into that medium.
That's right.
But the only way that would work is if the big telecom companies got their act together and put a lot of money and resources behind developing this sort of technology, which would be complicated. And so far, the telecom companies have been very sluggish in addressing this issue.
But do they see no upside for them? They don't want to even get into the mess?
I think they don't want to get in the mess, A, for legal reasons, because, and I don't know if they're saying this in good faith or not, but their argument is we're worried we could block legitimate calls from going through and open ourselves up to legal challenges. Yeah. I think the more accurate reason might just be that it's a huge lift and they just don't feel like doing it. So they've kind of passed the baton to some of these apps, but so far they haven't done a lot of the lifting themselves.
Simon Van Zwalenwood contributes to the Washington Post, most recently on the robocall thing that I will tell you what is hitting my house like you won't even believe. Simon, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This final note on the way out, related in a way to where we started, the price of goods imported to this country. You'll remember President Trump imposed tariffs yesterday on imported solar panels, also washing machines. Here's the Newtonian economics of that brought to life. Remember, equal opposite reaction to that phrase I coined, I think. The Wall Street Journal reports today that the Korean manufacturer LG Electronics is going to raise the price to consumers of its washing machines
by $50. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 41 today, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ down 45.6%. There, S&P 500 basically flat. As I said, a whole lot of sideways. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.